Welcome to the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast, where we explore family offices, real estate, and the art of preserving legacies and wealth. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and I'm going to be utilizing my experience of investing on behalf of a number of prominent families and working directly for a number of prominent families on their real estate portfolio. I'm going to tap into my decades worth of experience in real estate investing and relationships with some of the most prominent family office leaders in the industry, academics from universities around the world, and industry experts and leaders in the real estate space. So whether you're a family member, family office executive, family office, or real estate enthusiast, Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast will empower you with knowledge and influential voices. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and this is the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Family Office Real Estate Insights. Today, I have Joe Williams of Keller Williams with us. Joe, thanks for being on the show.
DJ, happy to be here.
So the first thing I want to do is I want to start off with a question that I'm sure you've been asked many, many, many times, and so this will be easy for you. But, you know, I would say the majority, if not all, know the name Keller Williams, and you happen to be the Williams part of that. So when did it start? If you could go back to the beginning and sort of how it evolved to, you know, where it is today.
It's, you know, DJ, in fact, it's funny, as long as you and I have known each other, I don't think you've ever really heard this story, but
no, I have not. No,
I lost my dad when I was young. I was 10 years old. And so it was mom and the three kids. And we all went to work, which was a great thing, by the way. And in that process, I ended up working retail for a really great Jewish family that I knew. And they had a series of toy stores, and they would always build them inside malls. And so I worked for them for a number of years. I really liked working with people. I think people that get into sales, they realize very early that, you know, I like solving problems for people, and I get along well with people. And so my mother at the time, I was managing beauty shops. Of course, today you'd call those hair salons, right? And one of her customers that was there every single week having their hair done was the ladies that sold real estate. And so they'd be talking to my mom going, you know, Bertie, you need to get that boy in real estate. I remember distinctly the day my mother came home and said, honey, have you ever thought about selling real estate? And I mean, my gosh, at the time I was maybe 16 years old, and I looked at my mom, I said, well, what is real estate? I'd never really heard the term. And she said, well, no, land, buildings and things. Well, turns out one of our best customers, we used to have these huge hobby, we had a hobby store inside the toy store. And we sold everything. I mean, trains, planes, you name it. Well, it turns out one of our best customers, Tony Specie, was one of the best real estate brokers there in San Antonio. So one day I asked Tony, I said, Tony, can you tell me about the real estate business? And he'd known me for 3 years, I think, secretly in his head. He's like, yeah, I'd love to hire this guy. So I came down to his office, and he was talking all about it. I said, man, this sounds like this is for me.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 19 years old.
Okay.
In fact, I was a freshman in junior college.
Okay.
So he starts filling out the application. And all of a sudden, he gets to my birthday. He goes, uh-oh. I'm like, what do you mean, uh-oh? I was, well, in Texas, you have to be 21 years old to have contractual majority to be able to get a license. And I said, well, there's got to be a way around this. He says, well, you know, that's an interesting question. So he called one of his fraternity brothers, David Carter, great guy. And I could hear Tony on the phone going, yeah, 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 that could work. Hangs up the phone, and I'm like, what can work? accidentally muted myself there, is it turns out in the state of Texas that if you're the oldest son of a surviving spouse, wow, that you can have contractual majority at 19 years old.
Wow.
And so, DJ, that's how I became probably one of the youngest real estate agents in the state of Texas at 19 years old. Wow. And so it was an easy jump from there when I ran out of my eligibility with junior college, mm-hmm, you know, which is 2 years. I enrolled at the University of Texas because back in those days, if you had a paid for a car and a roommate and you could work 40 hours a week, you could put yourself through state school.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did. So in 76, I got out, had a degree in real estate. Of course, that and $5 would get you a mocha at Starbucks, right? Went to work for a guy, J.B. Goodman, good guy, young broker. I knew his family from San Antonio. And worked for him for 8 years. About the third year that I was with JB, I wrote an article about how you recruit on college campuses, which was unusual for real estate brokers.
Right.
But we knew from time to time we could find some kids who generally their moms and dads were in real estate.
Yep.
And so they were at the college level for the same reason. And so we went to Baylor and interviewed a bunch of students. And guess what? One of the students there was Gary Keller, who turned out to be my partner. So about 1983, Gary and I had lunch one day, and he said, you know, I got an idea for starting a company, and I want to start it with you.
So you've been in the business at this time about 13 years or so?
Yeah, I got licensed in 73. So yeah, 10 years.
Okay.
So Gary and I sat down, laid out a plan, and in 83, we made the jump, started the company, obviously one office, and we had three good years. Actually, we started in December of 83. So we had 84 and 85, and then DJs, you remember, in 86, what's a nice way of saying the stuff hit the fan.
Well, that's when the tax ruling came out, right? They changed the tax laws.
Changed that. They eliminated the double declining balance depreciation, and it took everybody by surprise. Now, part of the issue you had there in Texas, oil dropped $7.50 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
You had the S&L crisis. You had the Resolution Trust Corporation step back in, shut down all those banks, shut down the savings loan industry. And so what could have been Armageddon turned into an incredible opportunity for Gary and I, because it made us sit down, take off the rose-colored glasses and go, what are we going to do?
Right.
This is going to be, Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Louisiana, as you know from the Colorado time, got flushed down the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
So it made us sit down with our agents and go, hey, we got to change some things. And I'm talking big changes. We got to look at the industry and figure out what we're doing wrong, revamp. The word you would use today, DJ, is disrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody used that word back in 1986. But that's exactly what we did. We took the industry, laid it out on a piece of paper and said, where can we make some major fundamental changes and come out the other side and be okay? And that was when we totally revamped the whole way real estate is done between the broker and the agent.
Okay, so what was going on before that?
Well, before that, the standard would be that most traditional brokers would look at you, mm-hmm, as the agent and say, hey, I'm the guy. I'm the brand. In other words, you go back to a place like Denver and you look at Van Schaack, right? Good guy, sharp guy, great guy. He was the brand. And the agents all worked for him.
Right.
So if you came to work for him, he had you on a 50-50, maybe a 60-40 split, but that was as good as your split was going to be.
Right.
And if you ever left, he kept your clients because they were his. They weren't really yours.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Totally.
So we went to the agents and said, you know what? We don't think that's how it actually works. We think that you, DJ, they're your clients. They're not really ours. You're the one that went out and got them. You're the one that proved that you know what you're doing. So here's what we're going to do. From now on, you're going to be the brand, not us. We're going to pour all of our money, our time, our expertise into turning you into your own business. And we're going to affiliate with you, but only in the areas where you really need our help. We're going to teach you how to go run your own business, because that's really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we think you're the brand, not Keller Williams. So starting today forward, we're not paying for any advertising. None. We're not buying your signs. We're not buying your lockbox. We're not doing any of that. But in fairness, we're going to readjust your commission split where you make all the money and we just make a little tiny bit to keep overhead running. And DJ, to their credit, they got it. Now, by the way, they didn't get it immediately. They're like, well
that's
you're,
a, yeah.
You're not paying for our ads? No, no, I'm not. But I'm going to give you the money. And if you think it makes sense to put an ad in the Denver newspaper, then by all means, you go do it. Well, what happened? What happened is for the first time, they had to evaluate their business as if they were the owner.
Yeah.
And trust me, it was an overnight revelation to them. But, you know, there's better ways to go spend our marketing dollars. And there were. And so it's like a good friend of mine once said, and this is very apropos. He said, Joe, hospitals don't have patients. Doctors do. But doctors can't function without a well-organized surgery center. And that's the hospital. So Gary and I looked at the agent and said, listen, we're going to become your surgery center. You as the doctors, you go work with your patients. You keep track of them. You interact with them. We're not going to interact with them at all. You are. And that at the time, DJ, you got to go back. This is 40 years ago, roughly. We had competitors look at us and go, you guys are nuts. I can't believe you're going to do that. Well, there's a certain level of trust that we need to develop here. But number one, when you look at really good companies, DJ, one thing is loud and clear to me, and that is that they have clarity about what their vision is for their operation. And the minute we said to the agents, hey, we think you're the focal point, not that we don't take care of the buyers and sellers, but they're your buyers and sellers. So the clarity was designing a program where they felt valued and they felt like we were really putting their best interest at heart. And that was the number one thing that we were able to do for them. But the minute you get that kind of clarity, it's amazing how making decisions for your operation becomes easy. Because no matter what decision comes down the line, we're sitting there going, okay, does this build their business? Does this help build the agents' careers? Does this help them build a better personal life? If it doesn't do those three things, we don't do it.
And so how long did it take for this to catch on?
It took Let me tell you what happened. So this was 1986, 87, 88. We refined the systems that we were going to use to accomplish all of this. By 89, we franchised our first office in San Antonio, Texas, because home office is here in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Dallas, and then we went to Louisiana, then we went to Oklahoma, then we came up to Denver. And by 1993, we had another monumental thing happen. We hired a guy, Bain Hinkey, good guy. God bless him, he passed during the pandemic. Thank you, Bain. Bain came in, he did two things. One, we had 60 offices at the time. He interviewed all of our 60 operating partners. Remember, we're a franchise now. He interviewed Gary, interviewed the management team. He came back, he said two things. Number one, I love your ideas. I love how you guys are rethinking the residential real estate business. I think your ideas are going to do well. Little did he know, right? Second thing he said, this is more important. He said, you guys don't know what you're doing. He said, you don't know anything about franchising. You don't know how to franchise. And DJ, he's correct. I mean, we're a classic case of a couple of real estate guys who really understand real estate well, but we weren't franchisers. We weren't. We could read books and things, but he came back and said, look, franchising is all about three things. Number one, having a product that you can franchise. In other words, you know, will the dog eat the dog food?
Mm-hmm.
Second, designing models that you never stray from.
Mm-hmm.
That are coordinated with systems that you design. So really what he was saying, it's all about models and systems.
Systems and processes.
And processes. He said, that's the thing I got to work with you guys on. And let me tell you, the number one model that we had to understand and system was, how do you go find talented people, talented franchise owners? Because it starts right there.
Yeah.
If you can do that, I've always said that's why when the Great Recession hit, you know, 07, 08, 09, 10, we were the only company that grew 4%. Everybody else fell way back behind. Why? Because we'd run into Bain Hinkey back in 93 and 94, and he taught us how you go find talented people. Without those people, we'd have the same issues everybody else had.
What was that solution?
Well, the solution was what he did. He designed a 10-step process that when you're going to go hire people, you got to take them through all 10 steps. And DJ, I'll tell you, it's excruciating. I mean, it's when we hire an operating partner.
Yeah.
It's about a 30-hour process. And by step six, you know if you're going to make an offer to them, okay? And so from step seven to 10, it's just refining the relationship you're going to have with them, okay? But by hiring Bain and going through that, because it took a couple of years with Bain, I mean, 94, 95, 96, once we got those models and systems down, that's when we hit that hockey stick growth. You know, we had, you know, at the time when we hired Bain, we had 3,500 agents, I guess, 60 offices. Next thing you know, we turned around, we had 15,000. Next year, we had 23. Next year, we had 32. And, you know, boom, 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 boom. But without that step with him, we would have never hit that kind of growth. Because as you know, the fun part's getting to number one. The hard part's staying there.
Mm-hmm. So what were, if you're able to, are you able to share the 10 steps and what you looked for?
Well, that almost could be a whole nother. Let me tell you this. In the initial steps, the initial three or four steps, it's about really diving in to the candidate. For example, I'll give you this is worth right here. Like you said, look, when DJ shows up, he's going to bring in an application. And by the way, we used his application, which is very different from most applications. It right. really asked for a lot of information. You're really diving deep.
Yep.
But he would say, look, DJ's going to walk in. There's going to be five people on that application. And all five of those people are going to be people who love DJ, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm calling on your references, they're all going to say this, oh, he's great, he's awesome, blah, blah, blah. And what he taught us to do was, let's say you give me a guy, Frank.
Yep.
Well, Frank, can I ask you a question? Is there anybody else you know who might have worked or knows DJ well? And he goes, well, yeah, you know, Gary Keller. I mean, we all worked at Nortel years ago. You have a number for Gary? Well, yeah, hold on a minute. Next thing you know, I now call Gary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, Gary, this, you know, and so I'm diving deeper and deeper and deeper. And eventually, DJ, if you ask that question again, and now I'm going to Howard.
Yeah.
I'm two or three levels deep. Howard doesn't have a dog in this hunt.
Mm-mm.
He's going to give me a real honest, you know, hey, here's what in fact, let me tell you, DJ, I've made calls for, or I'll talk to a guy. Yeah, I'm calling about DJ. And he says something like, is he out yet? Out? Oh, yeah. He embezzled some money when he was at Pioneer Bank. We're like, oh, my God. But flip side of that, I've also had people that go, well, Joe, let me just cut to the quick here. What job are you hiring DJ for? Well, we're looking at DJ for potential manager of an office. Slight pause. And then he goes, he'd be perfect for that. Really? Why do you say that? Oh, man, when he worked with us at Nortel, he should have been the manager. Mm-hmm. You with me?
Yeah.
So it's amazing as you dive in and go to those different levels, what you're going to find out about the candidate. Now, also, I will tell you, we're a big believer. You know, there's four basic personalities, DJ, out there.
Right. Okay. Yep.
And one of the things we've learned is that each of our job requirements has a personality style that will actually be perfect for it.
Right.
Okay. So we've really worked hard at trying to match those personality styles to the jobs. And I'd be the first to admit it's not a perfect science, but most of the time, it is.
Right.
It is.
Right.
It's kind of like I told all the office landlords right now, you know, we've got this complete digital makeover now where, you know, people work from home. And what I told the office landlords is, look, there's four basic personalities out there. Two of them could work from home. Two of them can't.
Yeah.
And it's not going to work well. So if I'm the boss today, I'm looking at my job descriptions and trying to determine if I send someone home, are they the type of personality that can do that? Because there's a lot of them going home and they can't do that.
Well, that's the thing. You have to. I mean, I remember when I started, I had to, oh, this was, I don't know, 20, maybe 15, 20 years ago. And I had to work out of my house. And it took significant discipline. And you're right. It's not for everybody.
And that's the thing. I mean, the thing we laughed about the most, what was it, 60 days ago, Zoom?
Yeah.
Which you and I are using right now.
Yep.
Chief executive officer at Zoom said, I want everybody back. He said, forget the remote, even though we're Zoom. I need y'all back in the office. So, and there's going to be another 2 years where everybody's trying to figure this out. This is not an overnight deal.
No.
Both know I can send an engineer home. That's not a problem. He just works on it. You know, he's happy to be home.
Yep.
He's a project. His job is done project by project. Okay. You can send him home. Yeah. So going further with the story, So by the early 2000s, KW success was really chugging fast. In fact, sometimes the rocket ship was flying so fast, we had pieces flying off the rocket.
Right.
We were doing the best we could. But I've always had the theory, and I think you may have heard me say this before, I call it the stable table theory. And by that, I mean any great endeavor, company, marriage, whatever. Typically, what you're going to find, very much like a table, you got to have four legs of that table that underpin that tabletop to give it the stability that it needs. And running a company is very much that same thing. The first leg of the table for us was the stability of knowing why we're in business. Well, clearly, we were in business to build the agents' careers or them to become the brand. That was very unusual, but it worked. The second was to figure out better economics so that they had the money to go do that. And so we were able to do that with a much, much better commission split. Now, part of the trade-off that we asked our agents is, look, I can give you a better commission split provided I'm running a larger office.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you and I both know there's only three ways to make money. One, you're monopolistic, which means you got a patent. You know, I mean, I got something that's totally protected and no one else has it. That's one way. Second way would be margins. Third would be volume.
Yep.
So, you can protect margins if you can differentiate yourself enough to do that in your industry. Well, in real estate, I can't do that. Everybody sells the same houses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't produce the product. We just provide a service.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same service that everybody does. So in our case, we opted for the third option, which was create more volume. Well, part of that was with our office. So we went to the agents and said, look, the average real estate office in America has maybe 40 agents in that office. We're going to design an office for 140 agents. And the agents said, well, why would you do that? Because if I have 140 agents in an office, I know instinctively that 20% of them are really going to make a good living. And they're the ones that are going to make enough money to pay our bills for the office. So if I can do that, I can give everybody a great split. In fact, we have a program, DJ, where we cap commissions, which at the time, nobody had ever heard of. What that meant is, after you sold X number of homes, I'm going to give you 100% of your commission. And that was very unusual at the time. But to do that, I had to run a larger office.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you are running a larger office, there's a lot of synergy you get from that. Because there's more listings coming in. There's more transactions being done. It's just better. So, and it scales better for us. Our expenses work better where I can get my expenses down to fixed expenses.
Right.
If I'm not paying for advertising, I don't have these variable expenses every month. I know what my expenses are. My rent, manager, the administrative people, the internet, all of that. We would hold that as a fixed expense. And then I was giving my agents the chance to make more money by running their own businesses. But that formula worked extremely well. And
so,
you could call that the second leg of our table.
Okay.
Much better economics. The third leg of the table was go get the best leaders. And of course, we've already talked about that. How do you go find the best talented people? Because that does make a difference. And by the way, if I'm running an office with 140 agents versus an office with 40, how much more can I pay to get better talent? A lot, a lot. So it just works. And to be honest, even we didn't understand how well this was going to work. to the point that I have some offices in cities, DJ, where we're running 600 and 700 agents out of that office. I remember, best way to illustrate it, I was in Washington, D.C. And I was at a function, person, had nothing to do with the business. And there was a manager there from one of our competitors up in the D.C. area, good guy. And we were talking, he says, well, Joe, don't you run some fairly large office? I said, yes. He said, what's the largest office you have? And I said, probably our original office in Southwest Austin. How many agents you have? I think we have 800 agents out of that office. And he looks at me and he goes, Joe, I've never heard of an office with 800 agents. And the answer, DJ, that I give him is always the same. I just looked at him and I said, and your point is? And he just laughed. He said, I get it. Because here's the thing. Big is not bad if it's organized. If it's not organized, it's chaos. So the key is figure out how to build a six-lane highway from the get-go. In other words, when you start out building your company, don't start out building it as a two-lane. Look at it and say, where are we going to go with this thing? And then get your structures in place. So as you're adding people, you're not driving yourself crazy. You're not having to reinvent the wheel. And that was a big part of what we did with our people. And we were able to go get the best. I've got 35 regional managers here in the United States. We're in 57 countries now. We know how important it is to go get the best people. Hire slow, fire fast. And we may take a long time looking at a country to make sure we've got a right person. And if it takes me a year to find them, it takes me a year to find them. But don't go hire the wrong person. The cost of a bad hire. When Bain stepped in to teach us how you go find talented people, the first thing he would do is he would sit down and take us through an exercise called the cost of a bad hire. And I got to tell you,
it's significant. It's significant.
It's significant. And no one ever does this, right? So we're going through this exercise of realizing, oh my gosh, you know, we hired the wrong guy. He was there for 6 months. He did all kind of damage. He ran off some of our best people. Then we finally fire him. Then we, you know, we got 2 months catching up. Mm-hmm. And so Bain would take you through this exercise. And man, it was an eye opener. And that was why he said the key is go get the best people. The fourth leg of this table for most companies is the same thing, and that is, how do I create a culture, an environment where people don't have to leave me? Okay. Can you create a company where once they're there, they're locked in for life? Now, understand, you're not going to do that at Chick-fil-A, right? I mean, Chick-fil-A, hopefully your manager's locked in, but you're gonna rotate through young high school kids all day long. So your system is set up for that. But most other companies, they really want to be able to hang on to their people. You know, you spend the time, you recruit, you train them, get them. You don't want them to up and leave 2 years later. So how do you go create a culture where people feel like you've really got their best interests at heart? And a lot of that is being able to understand who you're in business with. And when we looked at his 10 steps, those were the last three steps there where we aligned ourselves with what their interest was. Because the better I know you, the better I can interact with you and create a future that you would buy into.
Well, the other thing too is that, you know, back to what you said about the four personality types and the type of people, is that if you're around other people that are similar, right, then you're going to mesh, right? You're not going to have this friction. And, you know, I've always said to my kids too, I was like, if you do something that you like, then you're going to get good at it. And if you're good at it, you're going to like it more. And culture, and then being around people is a huge part of it.
And so what we did, and you'll appreciate this. So this is just one example of how we helped create the culture. I remember, and DJ, you and I are about the same age. I remember when I got out of college and I went to an Amway meeting, right? And I'm sitting there at the meeting and they're talking about selling soap, whatever. And then the guy gets up and he starts drawing the circles on the board.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the circles?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to sell soap. But I kept looking at the circles going, that's genius. Who thought that up? Now, if you look at multi-level circles in any industry, generally they get a bad rap because the product that they're selling is not that good, right? Or you've got charlatans running the whole multi-level deal. And the guys at the top make money and everybody at the bottom doesn't. Well, we went back to our agents and said, hey, we got an idea. We know by expanding the company with like-minded people that if we can do this and we can grow, everybody's going to do better for a number of reasons, okay? And when you think about the real estate industry, we're all salespeople generally. And if we can go find other good salespeople that come into our team, then all the better. So how do we give them the incentive to do that? Well, Gary and I thought up a way to use those circles inside of the company. And basically we said, okay, DJ, if you're out there and you run into somebody in Denver and they're not happy where they are, bring them over, let's talk to them. If they come to work and they go sell a house, whatever the company makes, I'm not talking about their commission. They keep their commission. Whatever the company makes from them, I'm going to take a percentage of that and I'm going to pay it to you. Now, everybody knows, DJ, that makes logical sense, right? But the cool thing about it is if they bring someone in and that person makes a sale, DJ, I'm not only going to pay you on the agent you brought in, but the agent they brought in. Well, that's pure multi-level, right?
It is. It's just ran in a, I don't want to say professional way, but it's a corporate way, right?
It's a corporate way. Well, here's what a lot of people don't know. And this is a wonderful story. You knew Trammell Crowe, right?
Yep.
One of the top developers in the world. He passed away years ago. God bless him. He did so many incredible things. Trammell used a system almost exactly that. He never called it multi-level, but if you brought Trammell, a guy in Orlando who became his partner there building industrial parks, Trammell would cut you in on the JVs that he did with that guy in Orlando. But if that guy in Orlando found somebody in Austin, Texas, Trammell did the same thing. He not only gave you a cut of the guy you found in Orlando, he gave you a cut of the stuff that was done in Austin. Well, DJ, it's the same exact formula. It's just nobody called it multi-level, but it's the same exact thing. And I remember reading his book, Master Builder, and Gary and I looked at that and said, this has been done. There's precedence for this. But nobody would dare call it multi-level, but that's exactly what it is. And so what we told our guys is, look, we're going to do it, but it's built on profits. So it's a pure profit share. If there's no profit, you're not going to make a dime out of the deal. If there's profit, we're going to share those profits on the multi-level basis. And that's how it worked.
Wow, that's absolutely fantastic. I met Trammell back in 08, maybe it was 09. I actually have his book too. He had a big old book, you know, that he had and stuff like that. But that's
Master
the first time
Building.
I heard that story, which is absolutely fantastic. So,